Oedipus said. Kotex explained how every engineer, in signing the Yoyodyne contract, also signed away the patent rights to any inventions he might come up with. "This stifles your really creative engineer," Kotex said, adding bitterly, "wherever he may be." "I didn't think people invented anymore," said Oedipus, sensing this would goad him. "I mean, who's there been, really, since Thomas Edison? Isn't it all teamwork now?" Bloody Chicklets, in his welcoming speech this morning, had stressed teamwork. "Teamwork," Kotex snarled, "is one word for it, yeah. What it really is a way to avoid responsibility. It's a symptom of the gutlessness of the whole society." "Goodness," said Oedipus. "Are you allowed to talk like that?" Kotex looked to both sides, then rolled his chair closer. "You know the Nephastus machine?" Oedipus only widened her eyes. "Well, this was invented by John Nephastus, who's up at Berkeley now. John's somebody who still invents things. Here, I have a copy of the patent." From a drawer, he produced a Xeroxed wad of papers, showing a box with a sketch of a bearded Victorian on its outside, and coming out of the top, two pistons attached to a crankshaft and flywheel. "Who's that with the beard?" asked Oedipus. "James Clerk Maxwell," explained Kotex, "a famous Scotch scientist who had once postulated a tiny intelligence known as Maxwell's demon. The demon could sit in a box among air molecules that were moving at all different random speeds and sort out the fast molecules from the slow ones. Fast molecules have more energy than slow ones. Concentrate enough of them in one place, and you have a region of high temperature. You can then use the difference in temperature between this hot region of the box and any cooler region to drive a heat engine. Since the demon only sat and sorted, you wouldn't have to put any real work into the system. So you would be violating the second law of thermodynamics, getting something for nothing, causing perpetual motion." "Sorting isn't work?" Oedipus said. "Tell them down at the post office you'll find yourself in a mailbag headed for Fairbanks, Alaska, without even a fragile sticker going for you." "It's mental work," Kotex said, "but not work in the thermodynamic sense." He went on to tell how the Nephastus machine contained an honest-to-God Maxwell's demon. All you had to do was stare at the photo of Clerk Maxwell and concentrate on which cylinder, right or left, you wanted the demon to raise the temperature in. The air would expand and push a piston. The familiar Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge photo, showing Maxwell in right profile, seemed to work best. Oedipus, behind her shades, looked around carefully, trying not to move her head. Nobody paid any attention to them. The air conditioning hummed on. IBM typewriters chiggered away. Swivel chairs squeaked. Fat reference manuals were slammed shut. Rattling blueprints folded and refolded. While high overhead, the long, silent fluorescent bulbs glared merrily. All with Yoyodyne was normal. Except right here, where Oedipus Moss, with 1,000 other people to choose from, had had to walk uncoerced into the presence of madness. "Not everybody can work it, of course," Kotex, having warmed to his subject, was telling her. "Only people with the gift. Sensitives, John calls them." Oedipus rested her shades on her nose and batted her eyelashes, figuring to coquette her way off this conversational hook. "Would I make a good sensitive, do you think?"
"You really want to try it? You could write to him. He only knows a few sensitives. He'd let you try."
Oedipus took out her little memo book and opened to the symbols she'd copied and the words, Shall I project a world?
Box 573, said Kotex.
In Berkeley.
No.
His voice gone funny, so that she looked up too sharply, by which time, carried by a certain momentum of thought, he'd also said,
In San Francisco, there's none.
And by then, knew he'd made a mistake.
He's living somewhere along Telegraph,
he muttered.
I gave you the wrong address.
She took a chance. Then the waste address isn't good anymore? But she'd pronounced it like a word, waste. His face congealed, a mask of distrust.
It's W-A-S-T-E, lady, he told her. An acronym, not waste, and we had best not go into it any further.
I saw it in a lady's john, she confessed. But Stanley Kotex was no longer about to be sweet-talked.
Forget it,
he advised, opened a book, and proceeded to ignore her. She, in her turn, clearly was not about to forget it. The envelope she'd seen Kotex doodling, what she'd begun to think of as the waste symbol on, had come, she bet, from John Nefastus, or somebody like him. Her suspicions got embellished by, of all people, Mike Fallopian of the Peter Pinguid Society.
Sure, this Kotex is part of some underground, he told her a few days later. An underground of the unbalanced, possibly. But then how can you blame them for being maybe a little bitter? Look what's happening to them. In school, they got brainwashed, like all of us, into believing the myth of the American inventor, Morse and his telegraph, Bell and his telephone, Edison and his light bulb, Tom Swift and his this or that. Only one man per invention. Then when they grew up, they found they had to sign over all their rights to a monster like Yo-Yo Dyne, got stuck on some project or task force or team, and started being ground into anonymity. Nobody wanted them to invent, only perform their little role in a design ritual already set down for them in some procedures handbook. What's it like, Oedipa, being all alone in a nightmare like that? Of course they stick together. They keep in touch. They can always tell when they come on another of their kind. Maybe it only happens once every 5 years, but still, immediately they know.
Metzger, who'd come along to the scope that evening, wanted to argue. You're so right-wing, you're left-wing, he protested. How can you be against a corporation that wants a worker to waive his patent rights? That sounds like the surplus value theory to me, fella, and you sound like a Marxist. As they got drunker, this typical Southern California dialogue degenerated further. Oedipa sat alone and gloomy. She decided to come tonight to the scope, not only because of the encounter with Stanley Kotex, but also because of other revelations, because it seemed that a pattern was beginning to emerge, having to do with the mail and how it was delivered. There had been the bronze historical marker on the other side of the lake at Fangoso Lagoons. On this site, it read, In 1853, a dozen Wells Fargo men battled gallantly with a band of masked marauders in mysterious black uniforms. We owe this description to a post rider, the only witness to the massacre, who died shortly after. The only other clue was a cross, traced by one of the victims in the dust. To this day, the identities of the slayers remain shrouded in mystery. A cross? Or the initial T? The same stuttered by Niccolo in the courier's tragedy. Oedipa pondered this. She called Randolph Driblet from a pay booth to see if he'd known about this Wells Fargo incident, if that was why he'd chosen to dress his bravos all in black. The phone buzzed on and on into hollowness. She hung up and headed for Zapf's used books. Zapf himself came forward out of a wan cone of 15-watt illumination to help her find the paperback Driblet had mentioned, Jacobean Revenge Plays.
"It's been very much in demand," Zapf told her.
The skull on the cover watched them through the dim light. Did he only mean Driblet? She opened her mouth to ask, but didn't. It was to be the first of many demurs. Back at Echo Courts, Metzger in L.A. for the day on other business, she turned immediately to the single mention of the word Tristero. Opposite the line, she read in pencil, "Compare Variant, 1687 edition. Put there maybe by some student." In a way, it cheered her. Another reading of that line might help light further the dark face of the word. According to a short preface, the text had been taken from a folio edition, undated. Oddly, the preface was unsigned. She checked the copyright page and found that the original hardcover had been a textbook, Plays of Ford, Webster, Turner, and Warfinger, published by the Lectern Press, Berkeley, California, back in 1957. She poured herself half a tumbler of Jack Daniels, the paranoids having left them a fresh bottle the evening before, and called the L.A. Library. They checked, but didn't have the hardcover. They could look it up on interlibrary loan for her. "Wait," she said, having just got an idea. "The publisher's up in Berkeley. Maybe I'll try them directly." Thinking also that she could visit John Nefastus. She had caught sight of the historical marker only because she'd gone back deliberately to Lake Inverarity one day, owing to this, what you might have to call, growing obsession with bringing something of herself, even if that something was just her presence, to the scatter of business interests that had survived Inverarity. She would give them order. She would create constellations. Next day, she drove out to Vesperhaven House, a home for senior citizens that Inverarity had put up around the time Yo-Yo Dine came to San Narciso. In his front recreation room, she found sunlight coming in, it seemed, through every window. An old man nodding in front of a dim Leon Schlesinger cartoon show on the tube, and a black fly browsing along the pink, dandruffy arroyo of the neat part in the old man's hair. A fat nurse ran in with a can of bug spray and yelled at the fly to take off so she could kill it. The cagey fly stayed where it was.
"You're bothering Mr. Thoth," she yelled at the little fellow.
Mr. Thoth jerked awake, jarring loose the fly, which made a desperate scramble for the door. The nurse pursued, spraying poison.
"Hello," said Oedipa.
"I was dreaming," Mr. Thoth told her. "About my grandfather. Very old man. At least, as old as I am now, 91. I thought, when I was a boy, that he had been 91 all his life. Now I feel," laughing, "as if I have been 91 all my life. Oh, the stories that old man would tell. He rode for the Pony Express back in the Gold Rush days. His horse was named Adolf. I remember that."
Oedipa, sensitized, thinking of the bronze marker, smiled at him as granddaughterly as she knew how, and asked, "Did he ever have to fight off desperados?"
"That cruel old man," said Mr. Thoth, "was an Indian killer. God, the saliva would come out in a string from his lip whenever he told about killing the Indians. He must have loved that part of it."
"What were you dreaming about him?"
"Oh, that,"
perhaps embarrassed.
"It was all
mixed in with a Porky Pig cartoon.
He waved at the tube.
It comes into your dreams, you know. Filthy machine. Did you ever see the one about Porky Pig and the anarchist?
She had, as a matter of fact, but said no.
The anarchist is dressed all in black. In the dark, you can only see his eyes. It dates from the 1930s. Porky Pig is a little boy. The children told me that he has a nephew now, Cicero. Do you remember during the war when Porky worked in a defense plant? He and Bugs Bunny. That was a good one, too.
Dressed all in black? Oedipa prompted him.
It was mixed in so with the Indians.
He tried to remember.
The dream. The Indians who wore black feathers. The Indians who weren't Indians, my grandfather told me. The feathers were white, but those false Indians were supposed to burn bones and stir the bone black with their feathers to get them black. It made them invisible in the night, because they came at night. That was how the old man, bless him, knew they weren't Indians. No Indian ever attacked at night. If he got killed, his soul would wander in the dark forever. Heathen.
If they weren't Indians, Oedipa asked, what were they?
A Spanish name,
Mr. Thoth said, frowning.
A Mexican name. Oh, I can't remember. Did they write it on the ring?
He reached down to a knitting bag by his chair and came up with blue yarn, needles, patterns, finally a dull gold signet ring.
My grandfather cut this from the finger of one of them he killed. Can you imagine a 91-year-old man so brutal?
Oedipa stared. The device on the ring was once again the waste symbol. She looked around, spooked at the sunlight pouring in all the windows, as if she had been trapped at the center of some intricate crystal, and said,
"My God!" "And I feel him certain days, days of a certain temperature," said Mr. Thoth, "and barometric pressure. Did you know that? I feel him close to me."
"Your grandfather?"
"No, my God."
So she went to find Fallopian, who ought to know a lot about the Pony Express and Wells Fargo if he was writing a book about them. He did, but not about their dark adversaries.
"I've had hints," he told her. "Sure. I wrote to Sacramento about that historical marker, and they've been kicking it around their bureaucratic morass for months. Someday they'll come back with a source book for me to read. It will say, 'Old-timers remember the yarn about whatever happened.' Old-timers. Real good documentation, this Californiana crap. Odds are the author will be dead. There's no way to trace it, unless you want to follow up an accidental correlation, like you got from the old man."
"You think it's really a correlation?" She thought of how tenuous it was, like a long white hair over a century long. Two very old men, all these fatigued brain cells between herself and the truth.
Marauders, nameless, faceless, dressed in black. Probably hired by the federal government. Those suppressions were brutal.
Couldn't it have been a rival carrier?
Fallopian shrugged.
Oedipa showed him the waste symbol, and he shrugged again.
"It was in the ladies' room, right here in the scope, Mike."
"Women," he only said. "Who can tell what goes on with them?"
If she'd thought to check a couple lines back in the Warfinger play, Oedipa might have made the next connection by herself. As it was, she got an assist from one Genghis Cohen, who is the most eminent philatelist in the L.A. area. Metzger, acting on instructions in the will, had retained this amiable, slightly adenoidal expert for a percent of his valuation to inventory and appraise Inverarity's stamp collection. One rainy morning, with mist rising off the pool, Metzger again away, the paranoids off somewhere to a recording session, Oedipa got rung up by this Genghis Cohen, who, even over the phone, she could tell was disturbed.
"There are some irregularities, Ms. Moss," he said. "Could you come over?"
She was somehow sure, driving in on the slick freeway, that the irregularities would tie in with the word Tristero. Metzger had taken the stamp albums to Cohen from safe deposit storage a week ago in Oedipa's Impala, and then he hadn't even been interested enough to look inside them. But now it came to her, as if the rain whispered it, that what Fallopian had not known about private carriers, Cohen might. When he opened the door of his apartment/office, she saw him framed in a long succession or train of doorways, room after room receding in the general direction of Santa Monica, all soaked in rain light. Genghis Cohen had a touch of summer flu. His fly was half open, and he was wearing a Barry Goldwater sweatshirt also. Oedipa felt at once motherly. In a room perhaps a third of the way along the suite, he sat her in a rocking chair and brought real homemade dandelion wine in small, neat glasses.
"I picked the dandelions in a cemetery 2 years ago. Now the cemetery is gone. They took it out for the East San Narciso Freeway."
She could, at this stage of things, recognize signals like that, as the epileptic is said to, an odor, color, pure, piercing grace note announcing his seizure. Afterward, it is only this signal, really dross, this secular announcement, and never what is revealed during the attack that he remembers. Oedipa wondered whether, at the end of this, if it were supposed to end, she too might not be left with only compiled memories of clues, announcements, intimations, but never the central truth itself, which must somehow each time be too bright for her memory to hold, which must always blaze out, destroying its own message irreversibly, leaving an overexposed blank when the ordinary world came back. In the space of a sip of dandelion wine, it came to her that she would never know how many times such a seizure may already have visited, or how to grasp it should it visit again, perhaps even in this last second. But there was no way to tell. She glanced down the corridor of Cohen's rooms in the rain, and saw for the very first time how far it might be possible to get lost in this.
"I have taken the liberty," Genghis Cohen was saying, "of getting in touch with an expert committee. I haven't yet forwarded them the stamps in question, pending your own authorization and, of course, Mr. Metzger's. However, all fees, I am sure, can be charged to the estate."
"I'm not sure I understand," Oedipa said.
"Allow me..."
He rolled over to her a small table, and from a plastic folder lifted with tweezers, delicately, a U.S. commemorative stamp, the Pony Express issue of 1940, 3 cents, Henna Brown. Canceled.
"Look,"
he said, switching on a small, intense lamp, handing her an oblong magnifying glass. "It's the wrong side," she said, as he swabbed the stamp gently with benzene and placed it on a black tray.
"The watermark."
Oedipa peered. There it was again, her waist symbol, showing up black, a little right of center. "What is this?" she asked, wondering how much time had gone by.
"I'm not sure," Cohen said. "That's why I've referred it, and the others, to the committee. Some friends have been around to see them, too, but they're all being cautious. But see what you think of this."
From the same plastic folder, he now tweezed what looked like an old German stamp, with the figures 1/4 in the center. The word Freimarke at the top, and along the right-hand margin, the legend Turn und Taxis. They were, she remembered from the Warfinger play, some kind of private couriers, right?
From about 1300 until Bismarck bought them out in 1867, Ms. Moss, they were the European mail service. This is one of their very few adhesive stamps. But look in the corners.
Decorating each corner of the stamp, Oedipa saw a horn with a single loop in it, almost like the waist symbol.
"A post horn," Cohen said. "The Turn and Taxis symbol. It was in their coat of arms."
"And tacit lies the gold once knotted horn," Oedipa remembered. "Sure." "Then the watermark you found," she said, "is nearly the same thing, except for the extra little doojigger sort of coming out of the bell."
"It sounds ridiculous," Cohen said. "But my guess is it's a mute."
She nodded. The black costumes, the silence, the secrecy. Whoever they were, their aim was to mute the Turn and Taxis post horn.
"Normally this issue and the others are unwatermarked," Cohen said. "And in view of other details, the hatching, number of perforations, way the paper has aged, it's obviously a counterfeit, not just an error."
"Then it isn't worth anything." Cohen smiled, blew his nose.
"You'd be amazed how much you could sell an honest forgery for. Some collectors specialize in them. And the question is, who did these? They're atrocious."
He flipped the stamp over and with the tip of the tweezers showed her. The picture had a Pony Express rider galloping out of a western fort. From shrubbery over on the right-hand side, and possibly in the direction the rider would be heading, protruded a single, painstakingly engraved, black feather.
"Why put in a deliberate mistake?" he asked, ignoring, if he saw it, the look on her face. "I've come up so far with 8 in all. Each one has an error like this, laboriously worked into the design, like a taunt. There's even a transposition. U.S. potsage, of all things."
"How recent?" blurted Oedipa, louder than she needed to be.
"Is anything wrong, Ms. Moss?"
She told him first about the letter from Mucho, with a cancellation telling her report all obscene mail to her potsmaster.
"Odd," Cohen agreed. "The transposition," consulting a notebook, "is only on the Lincoln 4-cent, regular issue, 1954. The other forgeries run back to 1893.
"That's 70 years," she said. "He'd have to be pretty old."
"If it's the same one," said Cohen. "And what if it were as old as Turn and Taxis?" "Omadio Tassis, banished from Milan, organized his first couriers in the Bergamo region around 1290.
They sat in silence, listening to rain gnaw languidly at the windows and skylights, confronted all at once by the marvelous possibility. "Has that ever happened before?" she had to ask.
"An 800-year tradition of postal fraud? Not to my knowledge."
Oedipa told him then all about old Mr. Thoth's signet ring, and the symbol she'd caught Stanley Kotex doodling, and the muted horn drawn in the ladies' room at the scope.
"Whatever it is," he hardly needed to say, "they're apparently still quite active."
"Do we tell the government or what?"
"I'm sure they know more than we do."
He sounded nervous or suddenly in retreat.
"No, I wouldn't. It isn't our business, is it?"
She asked him then about the initials, W-A-S-T-E, but it was somehow too late. She'd lost him. He said no, but so abruptly out of phase now with her own thoughts, he could even have been lying. He poured her more dandelion wine.
"It's clearer now," he said, rather formal. "A few months ago it got quite cloudy. You see, in spring, when the dandelions begin to bloom again, the wine goes through a fermentation, as if they remembered."
"No," thought Oedipa, sad, as if their home cemetery in some way still did exist, in a land where you could somehow walk and not need the East San Narciso freeway, and bones still could rest in peace, nourishing ghosts of dandelions, no one to plow them up, as if the dead really do persist, even in a bottle of wine. Chapter 5. Though her next move should have been to contact Randolph Driblet again, she decided instead to drive up to Berkeley. She wanted to find out where Richard Warfinger had got his information about Tristero. Possibly also take a look at how the inventor John Nefastus picked up his mail. As with Mucho when she'd left Kinneret, Metzger did not seem desperate at her going. She debated, driving north, whether to stop off at home on the way to Berkeley or coming back. As it turned out, she missed the exit for Kinneret, and that solved it. She purred along up the east side of the bay, presently climbed into the Berkeley hills, and arrived close to midnight at a sprawling, many-leveled German Baroque hotel, carpeted in deep green, going in for curved corridors and ornamental chandeliers. A sign in the lobby said, "Welcome California Chapter American Deaf-Mute Assembly." Every light in the place burned, alarmingly bright. A truly ponderable silence occupied the building. A clerk popped up from behind the desk where he'd been sleeping and began making sign language at her. Oedipa considered giving him the finger to see what would happen. But she'd driven straight through, and all at once the fatigue of it had caught up with her. The clerk took her to a room with a reproduction of a Remedios Varo in it, through corridors gently curving as the streets of San Narciso, utterly silent. She fell asleep almost at once, but kept waking from a nightmare about something in the mirror across from her bed. Nothing specific, only a possibility, nothing she could see. When she finally did settle into sleep, she dreamed that Mucho, her husband, was making love to her on a soft white beach that was not part of any California she knew. When she woke in the morning, she was sitting bolt upright, staring into the mirror at her own exhausted face. She found the Lectern Press in a small office building on Shattuck Avenue. They didn't have plays of Ford, Webster, Turner, and Warfinger on the premises, but did take her check for $12.50, gave her the address of their warehouse in Oakland, and a receipt to show the people there. By the time she'd collected the book, it was afternoon. She skimmed through to find the line that had brought her all the way up here, and in the leaf-fractured sunlight, froze. "No hallowed skein of stars can ward, I trow," ran the couplet, "who once has crossed the lusts of Angelo." "No," she protested aloud, "who's once been set his tryst with Tristero." The penciled note of the paperback had mentioned a variant, but the paperback was supposed to be a straight reprint of the book she now held. Puzzled, she saw that this edition also had a footnote. "According only to the quarto edition, 1687. The earlier folio has a lead inserted where the closing line should have been. D'Amico has suggested that Warfinger may have made a libelous comparison involving someone at court, and that the later restoration was actually the work of the printer, Inigo Barfstable. The doubtful Whitechapel version, circa 1670, has "this trist or odious awry, O Niccolo," which, besides bringing in a quite graceless Alexandrin, is difficult to make sense of syntactically, unless we accept the rather unorthodox, though persuasive, argument of J.K. Sale that the line is really a pun on "this tristero dies irae." This, however, it must be pointed out, leaves the line nearly as corrupt as before, owing to no clear meaning for the word tristero, unless it be a pseudo-Italianate variant on triste, wretched, depraved. But the Whitechapel edition, besides being a fragment, abounds in such corrupt and probably spurious lines, as we have mentioned elsewhere, and is hardly to be trusted. Then where, Oedipa wondered, does the paperback I bought at Zaff's get off with its tristero line? Was there yet another edition besides the quarto, folio, and Whitechapel fragment? The editor's preface, signed this time by one Emery Bortz, professor of English at Cal, mentioned none. She spent nearly an hour more searching through all the footnotes, finding nothing. "Damn it!" she yelled, started the car, and headed for the Berkeley campus to find Professor Bortz. She should have remembered the date on the book, 1957. Another world. The girl in the English office informed Oedipa that Professor Bortz was no longer with the faculty. He was teaching at San Narciso College, San Narciso, California. Of course, Oedipa thought. Rye? Where else? She copied the address and walked away, trying to remember who'd put out the paperback. She couldn't. It was summer, a weekday, and mid-afternoon. No time for any campus Oedipa knew of to be jumping, yet this one was. She came downslope from Wheeler Hall, through Sather Gate, into a plaza teeming with corduroy, denim, bare legs, blonde hair, horn rims, bicycle spokes in the sun, book bags, swaying card tables, long paper petitions dangling to earth, posters for undecipherable FSMs, YAFs, VDCs, suds in the fountain, students in nose-to-nose dialogue. She moved through it, carrying her fat book, attracted, unsure, a stranger, wanting to feel relevant, but knowing how much of a search among alternate universes it would take. For she had undergone her own educating at a time of nerves, blandness, and retreat among not only her fellow students, but also most of the visible structure around and ahead of them, this having been a national reflex to certain pathologies in high places only death had had the power to cure. And this Berkeley was like no somnolent Siwash out of her own past at all, but more akin to those Far Eastern or Latin American universities you read about, those autonomous culture media where the most beloved of folklores may be brought into doubt, cataclysmic of dissents voiced, suicidal of commitments chosen, the sort that bring governments down. But it was English she was hearing as she crossed Bancroft Way among the blonde children and the muttering Hondas and Suzukis. American English. Where were Secretaries James and Foster and Senator Joseph, those dear, daft noumena who'd mothered over Oedipa's so temperate youth? In another world. Along another pattern of track, another string of decisions taken, switches closed, the faceless pointsmen who'd thrown them now all transferred, deserted, in stir, fleeing the skip tracers, out of their skull, on horse, alcoholic, fanatic, under aliases, dead, impossible to find ever again. Among them, they had managed to turn the young Oedipa into a rare creature indeed, unfit perhaps for marches and sit-ins, but just a whiz at pursuing strange words in Jacobean texts. She pulled the Impala into a gas station somewhere along a gray stretch of Telegraph Avenue and found in a phone book the address of John Nefastus. She then drove to a pseudo-Mexican apartment house, looked for his name among the U.S. mailboxes, ascended outside steps, and walked down a row of draped windows till she found his door. He had a crew cut and the same underage look as Kotex, but wore a shirt on various Polynesian themes and dating from the Truman administration. Introducing herself, she invoked the name of Stanley Kotex. "He said you could tell me whether or not I'm a sensitive." Nefastus had been watching on his TV set a bunch of kids dancing some kind of a watusi. "I like to watch young stuff," he explained. "There's something about a little chick that age." "So does my husband," she said. "I understand." John Nefastus beamed at her, simpatico, and brought out his machine from a workroom in back. It looked about the way the patent had described it. "You know how this works?" "Stanley gave me a kind of rundown." He began then, bewilderingly, to talk about something called entropy. The word bothered him as much as Tristero bothered Oedipa. But it was too technical for her. She did gather that there were two distinct kinds of this entropy, one having to do with heat engines, the other to do with communication. The equation for one, back in the 30s, had looked very like the equation for the other. It was a coincidence. The two fields were entirely unconnected, except at one point, Maxwell's demon. As the demon sat and sorted his molecules into hot and cold, the system was said to lose entropy. But somehow the loss was offset by the information the demon gained about what molecules were where. "Communication is the key," cried Nefastus. "The demon passes his data on to the sensitive, and the sensitive must reply in kind. There are untold billions of molecules in that box. The demon collects data on each and every one. At some deep psychic level, he must get through. The sensitive must receive that staggering set of energies and feed back something like the same quantity of information to keep it all cycling. On the secular level, all we can see is one piston, hopefully moving. One little movement against all that massive complex of information, destroyed over and over with each power stroke."
"Help," said Oedipa. "You're not reaching me."
"Entropy is a figure of speech, then," sighed Nefastus. "A metaphor. It connects the world of thermodynamics to the world of information flow. The machine uses both. The demon makes the metaphor not only verbally graceful, but also objectively true."
"But what," she felt like some kind of a heretic, if the demon exists only because the two equations look alike, because of the metaphor? Nephastus smiled, impenetrable, calm, a believer. He existed for Clerk Maxwell long before the days of the metaphor. But had Clerk Maxwell been such a fanatic about his demon's reality? She looked at the picture on the outside of the box. Clerk Maxwell was in profile and would not meet her eyes. The forehead was round and smooth, and there was a curious bump at the back of his head, covered by curling hair. His visible eye seemed mild and noncommittal, but Oedipa wondered what hang-ups, crises, spookings in the middle of the night might be developed from the shadowed subtleties of his mouth, hidden under a full beard. "Watch the picture," said Nephastus, "and concentrate on a cylinder. Don't worry, if you're a sensitive, you'll know which one. Leave your mind open, receptive to the demon's message. I'll be back." He returned to his TV set, which was now showing cartoons. Oedipa sat through two Yogi Bears, one Megilla Gorilla, and a Peterpotamus, staring at Clerk Maxwell's enigmatic profile, waiting for the demon to communicate. "Are you there, little fellow?" Oedipa asked the demon. "Or is Nephastus putting me on?" Unless a piston moved, she'd never know. Clerk Maxwell's hands were cropped out of the photograph. He might have been holding a book. He gazed away into some vista of Victorian England whose light had been lost forever. Oedipa's anxiety grew. It seemed behind the beard he'd begun ever so faintly to smile. Something in his eyes, certainly, had changed. And there, at the top edge of what she could see, hadn't the right-hand piston moved a fraction? She couldn't look directly. The instructions were to keep her eyes on Clerk Maxwell. Minutes passed. Pistons remained frozen in place. High-pitched comic voices issued from the TV set. She had seen only a retinal twitch, a misfired nerve cell. Did the true sensitive see more? In her colon now, she was afraid, growing more so, that nothing would happen. Why worry, she worried. Nephastus is a nut, forget it, a sincere nut. The true sensitive is the one that can share in the man's hallucinations, that's all. How wonderful they might be to share. For 15 minutes more, she tried, repeating, "If you are there, whatever you are, show yourself to me. I need you. Show yourself." But nothing happened. "I'm sorry," she called in, surprisingly about to cry with frustration, her voice breaking. "It's no use." Nephastus came to her and put an arm around her shoulders. "It's okay," he said. "Please don't cry. Come on in on the couch. The news will be on any minute. We can do it there." "It?" said Oedipa. "Do it what?" "Have sexual intercourse," replied Nephastus. "Maybe there'll be something about China tonight. I like to do it while they talk about Vietnam, but China is best of all. You think about all those Chinese teeming, that profusion of life. It makes it sexier, right?" "Gah!" Oedipa screamed and fled, Nephastus snapping his fingers through the dark rooms behind her in a hippy-dippy, "oh, go ahead then, chick" fashion. He had doubtless learned from watching the TV also. "Say hello to old Stanley," he called, as she pattered down the steps into the street, flung a babushka over her license plate, and screeched away down Telegraph. She drove more or less automatically until a swift boy in a Mustang, perhaps unable to contain the new sense of virility his auto gave him, nearly killed her, and she realized that she was on the freeway, heading irreversibly for the Bay Bridge. It was the middle of rush hour. Oedipa was appalled at the spectacle, having thought such traffic only possible in Los Angeles, places like that. Looking down at San Francisco a few minutes later from the high point of the bridge's arc, she saw smog. Haze, she corrected herself, is what it is, haze. How can they have smog in San Francisco? Smog, according to the folklore, did not begin till farther south. It had to be the angle of the sun. Amid the exhaust, sweat, glare, and ill humor of a summer evening on an American freeway, Oedipa Maas pondered her Tristero problem. All the silence of San Narciso, the calm surface of the motel pool, the contemplative contours of residential streets like rakings in the sand of a Japanese garden, had not allowed her to think as leisurely as this freeway madness. For John Nefastus, to take a recent example, two kinds of entropy, thermodynamic and informational, happened, say by coincidence, to look alike when you wrote them down as equations. Yet he had made his mere coincidence respectable with the help of Maxwell's demon. Now here was Oedipa, faced with a metaphor of God knew how many parts, more than two anyway, with coincidences blossoming these days wherever she looked. She had nothing but a sound, a word, Tristero, to hold them together. She knew a few things about it. It had opposed the Tern and Taxis postal system in Europe. Its symbol was a muted post horn. Sometime before 1853, it had appeared in America and fought the Pony Express and Wells Fargo, either as outlaws in black or disguised as Indians. And it survived today in California, serving as a channel of communication for those of unorthodox sexual persuasion, inventors who believed in the reality of Maxwell's demon, possibly her own husband, Mucho Maas. But she'd thrown Mucho's letter long away. There was no way for Genghis Cohen to check the stamp, so if she wanted to find out for sure, she'd have to ask Mucho himself. Either Tristero did exist in its own right, or it was being presumed, perhaps fantasied, by Oedipa, so hung up on and interpenetrated with the dead man's estate. Here in San Francisco, away from all tangible assets of that estate, there might still be a chance of getting the whole thing to go away and disintegrate quietly. She had only to drift tonight, at random, and watch nothing happen, to be convinced it was purely nervous, a little something for her shrink to fix. She got off the freeway at North Beach, drove around, parked finally in a steep side street among warehouses, then walked along Broadway into the first crowds of evening. But it took her no more than an hour to catch sight of a muted post horn. She was moseying along a street full of aging boys in Ruse Atkins suits when she collided with a gang of guided tourists come rowdy-dowing out of a Volkswagen bus en route to take in a few San Francisco night spots. "Let me lay this on you," a voice spoke into her ear, "because I just left.